values, human rights, right and wrong. We just have this brief period where we also have to have some nice stats that we can wield. But we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that what actually moves people's hearts are the arguments based on the value of life. Blowing off quantitative analysis as bean counting is not just anti-intellectual, but works against values, human rights, right and wrong. Someone who values human life will favor the policies that have the greatest chance of saving people from being displaced or starved, while furnishing them with the means to live healthy and fulfilled lives. In a universe governed by the laws of nature rather than magic and deviltry, that requires bean counting. Even when it comes to the purely rhetorical challenge of moving people's hearts, efficacy matters. People are likelier to accept the fact of global warming when they are told that the problem is solvable by innovations in policy and technology than when they are given dire warnings about how awful it will be. Another common sentiment about how to prevent climate change is expressed in this letter of a kind I receive every now and again. Dear Professor Pinker, we need to do something about global warming. Why don't the Nobel Prize-winning scientists sign a petition? Why don't they tell the blunt truth that the politicians are pigs who don't care how many people get killed in floods and droughts? Why don't you and some friends start a movement on the Internet to get people to sign a pledge that they will make real sacrifices to fight global warming? Because that's the problem. Nobody wants to make any sacrifices. People should pledge to never fly in airplanes except in dire emergencies, because airplanes burn so much fuel. People should pledge to eat no meat on at least 3 days per week, because meat production adds so much carbon to the atmosphere. People should pledge to buy no jewelry, ever, because refining gold and silver is so energy intensive. We should abolish artistic pottery because it burns so much carbon. The potters in university art departments are just going to have to accept the fact that we can't go on like this. Forgive the bean counting, but even if everyone gave up their jewelry, it would not make a scratch in the world's emission of greenhouse gases, which are dominated by heavy industry, 29%, buildings, 18%, transport, 15%, land use change, 15%, and the energy needed to supply energy, 13%. Livestock is responsible for 5.5%, mostly methane rather than CO2, and aviation for 1.5%. Of course, my correspondent suggested foregoing jewelry and pottery not because of the effect, but because of the sacrifice. And it's no surprise that she singled out jewelry, the quintessential luxury. I bring up her ingenuous suggestion to illustrate two psychological impediments we face in dealing with climate change. The first is cognitive. People have trouble thinking in scale. They don't differentiate among actions that would reduce CO2 emissions by thousands of tons, millions of tons, and billions of tons, nor do they distinguish among level, rate, acceleration, and higher-order derivatives, between actions that would affect the rate of increase in CO2 emissions, affect the rate of CO2 emissions, affect the level of CO2 in the atmosphere, and affect global temperatures, which will rise even if the level of CO2 remains constant. Only the last of these matters. But if one doesn't think in scale and in orders of change, one can be satisfied with policies that accomplish nothing. The other impediment is moralistic. As I mentioned in Chapter 2, the human moral sense is not particularly moral. It encourages dehumanization. Politicians are pigs, and punitive aggression. Make the polluters pay. Also, by conflating profligacy with evil and asceticism with virtue, the moral sense can sanctify pointless displays of sacrifice. In many cultures, people flaunt their righteousness with vows of fasting, chastity, self-abnegation, bonfires of the vanities, and animal, or sometimes human, sacrifice. Even in modern societies, according to studies I've done with the psychologists Jason Nemiroff, Max Krasnow, and Rhea Howard, People esteem others according to how much time or money they forfeit in their altruistic acts, rather than by how much good they accomplish. Much of the public chatter about mitigating climate change involves voluntary sacrifices like recycling, reducing food miles, unplugging chargers, and so on. I myself have posed for posters in several of these campaigns led by Harvard students. But however virtuous these displays may feel, they are a distraction from the gargantuan challenge facing us. The problem is that carbon emissions are a classic public goods game, also known as a tragedy of the commons. People benefit from everyone else's sacrifices and suffer from their own, so everyone has an incentive to be a free rider and let everyone else make the sacrifice, and everyone suffers. A standard remedy for public goods dilemmas is a coercive authority that can punish free riders. But any government with the totalitarian power to abolish artistic pottery is unlikely to restrict that power to maximizing the common good. One can alternatively daydream that moral suasion is potent enough to induce everyone to make the necessary sacrifices. But while humans do have public sentiments, it's unwise to let the fate of the planet hinge on the hope that billions of people will simultaneously volunteer to act against their interests. Most important, the sacrifice needed to bring carbon emissions down by half and then to zero is far greater than foregoing jewelry. It would require foregoing electricity, heating, cement, steel, paper, travel, and affordable food and clothing. Climate justice warriors, indulging the fantasy that the developing world will do just that, advocate a regime of sustainable development. As Schellenberger and Ted Nordhaus satirize it, that consists of small co-ops in the Amazon forest where peasant farmers and Indians would pick nuts and berries to sell to Ben and Jerry's for their rainforest crunch flavor. They would be allowed solar panels that could light an LED or charge a cell phone, but nothing more. Needless to say, the people who actually live in those countries have a different idea. Escaping from poverty requires abundant energy. The proprietor of Human Progress, Marion Tupi, points out that in 1962, Botswana and Burundi were equally destitute, with an annual per capita income of $70, and neither emitted much CO2. By 2010, Botswanans earned $7,650 a year, 32 times as much as the still poor Burundians, and they emitted 89 times as much CO2. Faced with such facts, climate justice warriors reply that rather than enriching poor nations, we should impoverish rich ones, switching back, for example, to labor-intensive agriculture, to which an appropriate reply is, you first. Schellenberger and Nordhaus note how far progressive politics has moved from the days in which rural electrification and economic development were among its signature projects. In the name of democracy, it now offers the global poor not what they want, cheap electricity, but more of what they don't want, namely intermittent and expensive power. Economic progress is an imperative in rich and poor countries alike, precisely because it will be needed to adapt to the climate change that does occur. Thanks in good part to prosperity, humanity has been getting healthier, chapters 5 and 6, better fed, chapter 7, more peaceful, chapter 11, and better protected from natural hazards and disasters, Chapter 12. These advances have made humanity more resilient to natural and human-made threats. Disease outbreaks don't become pandemics. Crop failures in one region are alleviated by surpluses in another. Local skirmishes are defused before they erupt into war. Populations are better protected against storms, floods, and droughts. Part of our response to climate change must be to ensure that these gains in resilience continue to outpace the threats that a warming planet will throw at it. Every year that developing countries get richer, they will have more resources for building seawalls and reservoirs, improving public health services, and moving people away from rising seas. For that reason, they must not be kept in energy poverty. But neither does it make sense for them to raise incomes with massive coal burning that will overwhelm everyone later with weather disasters. How, then, should we deal with climate change? Deal with it we must. I agree with Pope Francis and the climate justice warriors that preventing climate change is a moral issue, because it has the potential to harm billions, particularly the world's poor. But morality is different from moralizing, and is often poorly served by it. The Pope's encyclical backfired, decreasing concern about climate change among the conservative Catholics who were aware of it. It may be satisfying to demonize the fossil fuel corporations that sell us the energy we want, or to signal our virtue by making conspicuous sacrifices, but these indulgences won't prevent destructive climate change. The enlightened response to climate change is to figure out how to get the most energy with the least emission of greenhouse gases. There is, to be sure, a tragic view of modernity, in which this is impossible. Industrial society, powered by flaming carbon, contains the fuel of its own destruction. But the tragic view is incorrect. Aucebel notes that the modern world has been progressively decarbonizing. The hydrocarbons in the stuff we burn are composed of hydrogen and carbon, which release energy as they combine with oxygen to form H2O and CO2. The oldest hydrocarbon fuel, dry wood, has a ratio of combustible carbon atoms to hydrogen atoms of about 10 to 1. The coal which replaced it during the Industrial Revolution has an average carbon to hydrogen ratio of 2 to 1. A petroleum fuel such as kerosene may have a ratio of 1 to 2. Natural gas is composed mainly of methane, whose chemical formula is CH4, with a ratio of 1 to 4. So as the industrial world climbed an energy ladder from wood to coal to oil to gas, the last transition accelerated in the 21st century by the abundance of shale gas from fracking, the ratio of carbon to hydrogen in its energy source steadily fell. And so did the amount of carbon that had to be burned to release a unit of energy, from 30 kilograms of carbon per gigajoule in 1850 to about 15 today. Figure 10-7 shows that carbon emissions follow a Kuznets arc. When rich countries such as the United States and the United Kingdom first industrialized, they emitted more and more CO2 to produce a dollar of GDP. But they turned a corner in the 1950s and since then have been emitting less and less. China and India are following suit, cresting in the late 1970s and mid-1990s, respectively. China flew off the charts in the late 1950s because of Mao's boneheaded schemes like backyard iron smelters with copious emissions and zero economic output. Carbon intensity for the world as a whole has been declining for half a century. Decarbonization is a natural consequence of people's preferences. Carbon blackens miners' lungs, endangers urban air, and threatens climate change, Aucebel explains. Hydrogen is as innocent as an element can be, ending combustion as water. People want their energy dense and clean, and as they move into cities they accept only electricity and gas delivered right to their bedside and stovetop. Remarkably, this natural development has brought the world to peak coal, and maybe even peak carbon. As Figure 10-8 shows, global emissions plateaued from 2014 to 2015, and declined among the top three emitters, namely China, the European Union, and the United States. As we saw for the United States in Figure 10-3, carbon emissions plateaued while prosperity rose. Between 2014 and 2016, the gross world product grew by 3% annually. Some of the carbon was reduced by the growth of wind and solar power, but most of it, particularly in the United States, was reduced by the replacement of C-137, H-97O9NS coal with CH4 gas. The long sweep of decarbonization shows that economic growth is not synonymous with burning carbon. Some optimists believe that if the trend is allowed to evolve into its next phase, from low-carbon natural gas to zero-carbon nuclear energy, a process abbreviated as N2N, the climate will have a soft landing. But only the sunniest believe this will happen by itself. Annual CO2 emissions may have leveled off for the time being at around 36 billion tons, but that's still a lot of CO2 added to the atmosphere every year, and there is no sign of the precipitous plunge we would need to stave off the harmful outcomes. Instead, decarbonization needs to be helped along with pushes from policy and technology, an idea called deep decarbonization. It begins with carbon pricing, charging people and companies for the damage they do when they dump their carbon into the atmosphere, either as a tax on carbon or as a national cap with tradable credits. Economists across the political spectrum endorse carbon pricing because it combines the unique advantages of governments and markets. No one owns the atmosphere, so people and companies have no reason to stint on emissions that allow each of them to enjoy their energy while harming everyone else, a perverse outcome that economists call a negative externality, another name for the collective costs in a public goods game or the damage to the commons in the tragedy of the commons. A carbon tax, which only governments can impose, internalizes the public costs, forcing people to factor the harm into every carbon-emitting decision they make, having billions of people decide how best to conserve, given their values and the information conveyed by prices, is bound to be more efficient and humane than having government analysts try to divine the optimal mixture from their desks. The potters don't have to hide their kilns from the carbon police. They can do their part in saving the planet by taking shorter showers, foregoing Sunday drives, and switching from beef to eggplant. Parents don't have to calculate whether diaper services with their trucks and laundries emit more carbon than the makers of disposable diapers. The difference will be folded into the prices, and each company has an incentive to lower its emissions to compete with the other. Inventors and entrepreneurs can take risks on carbon-free energy sources that would compete against fossil fuels on a level playing field, rather than the tilted one we have now, in which the fossils get to spew their waste into the atmosphere for free. Without carbon pricing, fossil fuels, which are uniquely abundant, portable, and energy-dense, have too great an advantage over the alternatives. Carbon taxes, to be sure, hit the poor in a way that concerns the left, and they transfer money from the private to the public sector in a way that annoys the right. But these effects can be neutralized by adjusting sales, payroll, income, and other taxes and transfers. As Al Gore put it, tax what you burn, not what you earn. And if the tax starts low and increases steeply and predictably over time, people can factor the increase into their long-term purchases and investments, and by favoring low-carbon technologies as they evolve, escape most of the tax altogether. A second key to deep decarbonization brings up an inconvenient truth for the traditional green movement. Nuclear power is the world's most abundant and scalable carbon-free energy source. Although renewable energy sources, particularly solar and wind, have become drastically cheaper, and their share of the world's energy has more than tripled in the past 5 years, that share is still a paltry 1.5%, and there are limits on how high it can go. The wind is often becalmed and the sun sets every night and may be clouded over. But people need energy around the clock, rain or shine. Batteries that could store and release large amounts of energy from renewables will help, but ones that could work on the scale of cities are years away. Also, wind and solar sprawl over vast acreage, defying the densification process that is friendliest to the environment. The energy analyst Robert Bryce estimates that simply keeping up with the world's increase in energy use would require turning an area the size of Germany into wind farms every year. To satisfy the world's needs with renewables by 2050 would require tiling windmills and solar panels over an area the size of the United States, including Alaska, plus Mexico, Central America, and the inhabited portion of Canada. Nuclear energy, in contrast, represents the ultimate in density, because in a nuclear reaction, E equals MC squared. You get an immense amount of energy, proportional to the speed of light squared, from a small bit of mass. Mining the uranium for nuclear energy leaves a far smaller environmental scar than mining coal, oil, or gas, and the power plants themselves take up about 1/500th of the land needed by wind or solar. Nuclear energy is available around the clock, and it can be plugged into power grids that provide concentrated energy where it is needed. It has a lower carbon footprint than solar, hydro, and biomass, and it's safer than them, too. The 60 years with nuclear power have seen 31 deaths in the 1986 Chernobyl disaster, the result of extraordinary Soviet-era bungling, together with a few thousand early deaths from cancer above the 100,000 natural cancer deaths in the exposed population. The other two famous accidents, at Three Mile Island in 1979 and Fukushima in 2011, killed no one. Yet vast numbers of people are killed day in, day out by the pollution from burning combustibles and by accidents in mining and transporting them, none of which make headlines. Compared with nuclear power, natural gas kills 38 times as many people per kilowatt hour of electricity generated, biomass 63 times as many, petroleum 243 times as many, and coal 387 times as many. Perhaps a million deaths a year. Nordhaus and Schellenberger summarize the calculations of an increasing number of climate scientists. There is no credible path to reducing global carbon emissions without an enormous expansion of nuclear power. It is the only low-carbon technology we have today with the demonstrated capability to generate large quantities of centrally generated electric power. The Deep Carbonization Pathways Project, a consortium of research teams that have worked out roadmaps for countries to reduce their emissions enough to meet the 2 degrees centigrade target, estimates that the United States will have to get between 30% and 60% of its electricity from nuclear power by 2050, 1.5 to 3 times the current fraction, at the same time that it generates far more of that electricity to take over from fossil fuels in heating homes, powering vehicles, and producing steel, cement, and fertilizer. In one scenario, this would require quadrupling its nuclear capacity. Similar expansions would be necessary in China, Russia, and other countries. Unfortunately, the use of nuclear power has been shrinking just when it should be growing. In the United States, 11 nuclear reactors have recently been closed or are threatened with closure, which would cancel the entire carbon savings from the expanded use of solar and wind. Germany, which has relied on nuclear energy for much of its electricity, is shutting down its plants as well, increasing its carbon emissions from the coal-fired plants that replace them, and France and Japan may follow its lead. Why are Western countries going the wrong way? Nuclear power presses a number of psychological buttons: fear of poisoning, ease of imagining catastrophes, distrust of the unfamiliar, and the man-made. And the dread has been amplified by the traditional green movement and its dubiously progressive supporters. One commentator blames global warming on the Doobie Brothers, Bonnie Raitt, and the other rock stars whose 1979 No Nukes concert and film galvanized baby boomer sentiment against nuclear power. Sample lyrics of the closing anthem, "Just give me the warm power of the sun, but won't you take all your atomic poison power away?" Some of the blame might go to Jane Fonda, Michael Douglas, and the producers of the 1979 disaster film The China Syndrome, so named because the melted-down nuclear reactor core would supposedly sink through the Earth's crust all the way to China, after making an area the size of Pennsylvania uninhabitable. In a devilish coincidence, the Three Mile Island plant in central Pennsylvania suffered its partial meltdown 2 weeks after the movie's release, creating widespread panic and making the very idea of nuclear power as radioactive as its uranium fuel. It's often said that with climate change, those who know the most are the most frightened. But with nuclear power, those who know the most are the least frightened. As with oil tankers, cars, planes, buildings, and factories, Chapter 12, engineers have learned from the accidents and near misses and have progressively squeezed more safety out of nuclear reactors, reducing the risks of accidents and contamination far below those of fossil fuels. The advantage even extends to radioactivity, which is a natural property of the fly ash and flue gases emitted by burning coal. Still, nuclear power is expensive. mainly because it must clear crippling regulatory hurdles while its competitors have been given easy passage. Also, in the United States, nuclear power plants are now being built after a lengthy hiatus by private companies using idiosyncratic designs, so they have not climbed the engineer's learning curve and settled on the best practices in design, fabrication, and construction. Sweden, France, and South Korea, in contrast, have built standardized reactors by the dozen and now enjoy cheap electricity with substantially lower carbon emissions. As Ivan Selin, former commissioner of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, put it, the French have two kinds of reactors and hundreds of kinds of cheese, whereas in the United States, the figures are reversed. For nuclear power to play a transformative role in decarbonization, it will eventually have to leap past the second-generation technology of light water reactors. The first generation consisted of prototypes from the 1950s and early 1960s. Soon to come online are a few Generation 3 reactors, which evolved from the current designs with improvements in safety and efficiency, but so far have been plagued by financial and construction snafus. Generation 4 reactors comprise a half dozen new designs, which promise to make nuclear plants a mass-produced commodity rather than finicky, limited additions. One type might be cranked out on an assembly line like jet engines, fitted into shipping containers, transported by rail, and installed on barges anchored offshore cities. This would allow them to clear the NIMBY hurdle, ride out storms or tsunamis, and be towed away at the end of their useful lives for decommissioning. Depending on the design, they could be buried and operated underground, cooled by inert gas or molten salt that needn't be pressurized, refueled continuously with a stream of pebbles rather than shut down for the replacement of fuel rods, equipped to cogenerate hydrogen, the cleanest of fuels, and designed to shut themselves off without power or human intervention if they overheat. Some would be fueled by relatively abundant thorium, and others by uranium extracted from seawater, from dismantled nuclear weapons, the ultimate beating of swords into plowshares, from the waste of existing reactors, or even from their own waste. The closest we will ever get to a perpetual motion machine, capable of powering the world for thousands of years. Even nuclear fusion, long derided as the energy source that is 30 years away and always will be, really may be 30 years away, or less, this time. The benefits of advanced nuclear energy are incalculable. Most climate change efforts call for policy reforms, such as carbon pricing, which remain contentious and will be hard to implement worldwide even in the rosiest scenarios. An energy source that is cheaper, denser, and cleaner than fossil fuels would sell itself, requiring no Herculean political will or international cooperation. It would not just mitigate climate change, but furnish manifold other gifts. People in the developing world could skip the middle rungs in the energy ladder, bringing their standard of living up to that of the West, without choking on coal smoke. Affordable desalination of seawater, an energy-ravenous process, could irrigate farms, supply drinking water, and, by reducing the need for both surface water and hydropower, allow dams to be dismantled, restoring the flow of rivers to lakes and seas, and revivifying entire ecosystems. The team that brings clean and abundant energy to the world will benefit humanity more than all of history's saints, heroes, prophets, martyrs, and laureates combined. Breakthroughs in energy may come from startups founded by idealistic inventors, from the skunk works of energy companies, or from the vanity projects of tech billionaires, especially if they have a diversified portfolio of safe bets and crazy moonshots. But research and development will also need a boost from governments, because these global public goods are too great a risk, with too little reward for private companies. Governments must play a role because, as Brand points out, infrastructure is one of the things we hire governments to handle, especially energy infrastructure, which requires no end of legislation, bonds, rights of way, regulations, subsidies, research, and public-private contracts with detailed oversight. This includes a regulatory environment that is suited to 21st century challenges, rather than to 1970s-era technophobia and nuclear dread. Some fourth-generation nuclear technologies are shovel-ready, but are trussed in regulatory green tape and may never see the light of day, at least not in the United States. China, Russia, India, and Indonesia, which are hungry for energy, sick of smog and free from American squeamishness and political gridlock, may take the lead. Whoever does it, and whichever fuel they use, the success of deep decarbonization will hinge on technological progress. Why assume that the know-how of 2018 is the best the world can do? Decarbonization will need breakthroughs not just in nuclear power, but on other technological frontiers, batteries to store the intermittent energy from renewables, internet-like smart grids that distribute electricity from scattered sources to scattered users at scattered times, technologies that electrify and decarbonize industrial processes, such as the production of cement, fertilizer, and steel, liquid biofuels for heavy trucks and planes that need dense, portable energy, and methods of capturing and storing CO2. The last of these is critical for a simple reason. Even if greenhouse gas emissions are halved by 2050 and zeroed by 2075, the world would still be on course for risky warming, because the CO2 already emitted will remain in the atmosphere for a very long time. It's not enough to stop thickening the greenhouse. At some point, we have to dismantle it. The basic technology is more than a billion years old. Plants suck carbon out of the air as they use the energy in sunlight to combine CO2 with H2O and make sugars like C6H12O6, cellulose, a chain of C6H10O5 units, and lignin, a chain of units like C10H14O4. The latter two make up most of the biomass in wood and stems. The obvious way to remove CO2 from the air, then, is to recruit as many carbon-hungry plants as we can to help us. We can do this by encouraging the transition from deforestation to reforestation and afforestation, planting new forests, by reversing tillage and wetland destruction, and by restoring coastal and marine habitats, and to reduce the amount of carbon that returns to the atmosphere when dead plants rot. We could encourage building with wood and other plant products, or cook the biomass into non-rotting charcoal and bury it as a soil amendment called biochar. Other ideas for carbon capture span a broad range of flakiness, at least by the standards of current technology. The more speculative end shades into geoengineering and includes plans to disperse pulverized rock that takes up CO2 as it weathers, to add alkali to clouds or the oceans to dissolve more CO2 in water, and to fertilize the ocean with iron to accelerate photosynthesis by plankton. The more proven end consists of technologies that can scrub CO2 from the smokestacks of fossil fuel plants and pump it into nooks and crannies in the Earth's crust. Skimming the sparse 400 parts per million directly from the atmosphere is theoretically possible, but prohibitively inefficient, though that could change if nuclear power became cheap enough. The technologies can be retrofitted into existing factories and power plants, and though they are themselves energy-hungry, they could slash carbon emissions from the vast energy infrastructure that is already in place, resulting in so-called clean coal. The technologies can also be fitted onto gasification plants that convert coal into liquid fuels, which may still be needed for planes and heavy trucks. The geophysicist Daniel Schrag points out that the gasification process already has to separate CO2 from the gas stream, so sequestering that CO2 to protect the atmosphere is a modest incremental expense, and it would yield liquid fuel with a smaller carbon footprint than that of petroleum. Better still, if the coal feedstock is supplemented with biomass, including grasses, agricultural waste, forest cuttings, municipal garbage, and perhaps someday genetically engineered plants or algae, it could be carbon neutral. Best of all, if the feedstock consisted exclusively of biomass, it would be carbon negative. The plants pull CO2 out of the atmosphere, and when their biomass is used for energy, via combustion, fermentation, or gasification, the carbon capture process keeps it out. The combination, sometimes called BECCS, bioenergy with carbon capture and storage, has been called climate change's savior technology. Will any of this happen? The obstacles are unnerving. They include the world's growing thirst for energy, the convenience of fossil fuels with their vast infrastructure, the denial of the problem by energy corporations and the political right, the hostility to technological solutions from traditional Greens and the climate justice left, and the tragedy of the carbon commons. For all that, preventing climate change is an idea whose time has come. One indication is a trio of headlines that appeared in Time magazine within a three-week span in 2015. China shows it's serious about climate change. Walmart, McDonald's, and 79 others commit to fight global warming. And Americans' denial of climate change hits record low. In the same season, the New York Times reported, poll finds global consensus on a need to tackle climate change. In all but one of the 40 countries surveyed, Pakistan, a majority of respondents were in favor of limiting greenhouse gas emissions, including 69% of the Americans. The global consensus is not just hot air. In December 2015, 195 countries signed a historic agreement that committed them to keeping the global temperature rise to well below 2 degrees Celsius, with a target of 1.5 degrees Celsius, and to setting aside $100 billion annually in climate mitigation financing for developing countries, which had been a sticking point in prior unsuccessful attempts at a global consensus. In October 2016, 115 of the signatories ratified the agreement, putting it into force. Most of the signatories submitted detailed plans on how they would pursue these goals through 2025, and all promised to update their plans every 5 years with stepped-up efforts. Without this ratcheting, the current plans are inadequate. They would allow the world's temperature to rise by 2.7 degrees Celsius, and would reduce the chance of a dangerous 4 degrees Celsius rise in 2100 by only 75%, which is still too close for comfort. But the public commitments, combined with contagious technological advances, could push the ratchet upward, in which case the Paris Agreement would substantially reduce the likelihood of a 2 degrees Celsius rise, and essentially eliminate the possibility of a 4 degrees Celsius rise. This game plan faced a setback in 2017 when Donald Trump, who had notoriously called climate change a Chinese hoax, announced that the United States would withdraw from the agreement. Even if the withdrawal takes place in November 2020, the earliest possible date, the decarbonization driven by technology and economics will continue, and climate change policies will be advanced by cities, states, business and tech leaders, and the world's other countries, which have declared the deal irreversible and may pressure the United States to keep its word by imposing carbon tariffs on American exports and other sanctions. Even with fair winds and following seas, the effort needed to prevent climate change is immense, and we have no guarantee that the necessary transformations in technology and politics will be in place soon enough to slow down global warming before it causes extensive harm. This brings us to a last-ditch protective measure, lowering the world's temperature by reducing the amount of solar radiation that reaches the lower atmosphere and Earth's surface. A fleet of airplanes could spray a fine mist of sulfates, calcite, or nanoparticles into the stratosphere, spreading a thin veil that would reflect back just enough sunlight to prevent dangerous warming. This would mimic the effects of a volcanic eruption such as that of Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines in 1991, which spewed so much sulfur dioxide into the atmosphere that the planet cooled down by half a degree Celsius, about 1 degree Fahrenheit, for 2 years. Or a fleet of cloud ships could spray a fine mist of seawater into the air. As the water evaporated, salt crystals would waft into the clouds and water vapor would condense around them, forming droplets that would whiten the clouds and reflect more sunlight back into space. These measures are relatively inexpensive, require no exotic new technologies, and could bring global temperatures down quickly. Other ideas for manipulating the atmosphere and oceans have been bruited about as well, though research on all of them is in its infancy. The very idea of climate engineering sounds like the crazed scheme of a mad scientist, and it once was close to taboo. Critics see it as a Promethean folly that could have unintended consequences, such as disrupting rainfall patterns and damaging the ozone layer. Since the effects of any measure applied to the entire planet are uneven from place to place, climate engineering raises the question of whose hand should be on the world's thermostat. As with a bickering couple, if one country lowered the temperature at the expense of another, it could set off a war. Once the world depended on climate engineering, then if for any reason it slacked off, temperatures in the carbon-soaked atmosphere would soar far more quickly than people could adapt. The mere mention of an escape hatch for the climate crisis creates a moral hazard, tempting countries to shirk their duty to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And the accumulated CO2 in the atmosphere would continue to dissolve in seawater, slowly turning the oceans into carbonic acid. For all these reasons, no responsible person could maintain that we can just keep pumping carbon into the air and slather sunscreen onto the stratosphere to compensate. But in a 2013 book, the physicist David Keith makes a case for a form of climate engineering that is moderate, responsive, and temporary. Moderate means that the amounts of sulfate or calcite would be just enough to reduce the rate of warming, not cancel it altogether. Moderation is a virtue because small manipulations are less likely to bring unwelcome surprises. Responsive means that any manipulation would be careful, gradual, closely monitored, constantly adjusted, and, if indicated, halted altogether. And temporary means that the program would be designed only to give humanity breathing space until it eliminates greenhouse gas emissions and brings the CO2 in the atmosphere back to pre-industrial levels. In response to the fear that the world would become addicted to climate engineering forever, Keith remarks, "Is it plausible that we will not figure out how to pull, say, 5 gigatons of carbon per year out of the air by 2075? I don't buy it." Though Keith is among the world's foremost climate engineers, he cannot be accused of being carried away by innovation thrill. A similarly thoughtful case may be found in the journalist Oliver Morton's 2015 book, The Planet Remade, which presents the historical, political, and moral dimensions of climate engineering alongside the technical state of the art. Morton shows that humanity has been disrupting global cycles of water, nitrogen, and carbon for more than a century, so it's too late to preserve a primeval Earth system. And given the enormity of the climate change problem, it's unwise to assume we will solve it quickly or easily. Research into how we might minimize the harm to millions of people before the solutions are completely in place only seems prudent, and Morton lays out scenarios of how a program of moderate and temporary climate engineering might be implemented even in a world that falls short of ideal global governance. The legal scholar Dan Kahan has shown that, far from creating a moral hazard, providing information about climate engineering makes people more concerned about climate change and less biased by their political ideology. Despite a half century of panic, humanity is not on an irrevocable path to ecological suicide. The fear of resource shortages is misconceived. So is the misanthropic environmentalism that sees modern humans as vile despoilers of a pristine planet. An enlightened environmentalism recognizes that humans need to use energy to lift themselves out of the poverty to which entropy and evolution consign them. It seeks the means to do so with the least harm to the planet and the living world. History suggests that this modern, pragmatic, and humanistic environmentalism can work. As the world gets richer and more tech-savvy, it dematerializes, decarbonizes, and densifies, sparing land and species. As people get richer and better educated, they care more about the environment, figure out ways to protect it, and are better able to pay the costs. Many parts of the environment are rebounding, emboldening us to deal with the admittedly severe problems that remain. First among them is the emission of greenhouse gases and the threat they pose of dangerous climate change. People sometimes ask me whether I think that humanity will rise to the challenge or whether we will sit back and let disaster unfold. For what it's worth, I think we'll rise to the challenge. But it's vital to understand the nature of this optimism. The economist Paul Romer distinguishes between complacent optimism, the feeling of a child waiting for presents on Christmas morning, and conditional optimism, the feeling of a child who wants a treehouse and realizes that if he gets some wood and nails and persuades other kids to help him, he can build one. We cannot be complacently optimistic about climate change, but we can be conditionally optimistic. We have some practicable ways to prevent the harms, and we have the means to learn more. Problems are solvable. That does not mean that they will solve themselves, but it does mean that we can solve them if we sustain the benevolent forces of modernity that have allowed us to solve problems so far, including societal prosperity, wisely regulated markets, international governance, and investments in science and technology. Chapter 11. Peace. How deep do the currents of progress flow? Can they suddenly come to a halt or go into reverse? The history of violence provides an opportunity to confront these questions. In The Better Angels of Our Nature, I showed that, as of the first decade of the 21st century, every objective measure of violence had been in decline. As I was writing it, reviewers warned me that it could all explode before the first copy hit the stores. A war, possibly nuclear, between Iran and either Israel or the United States was the worry of the day. Since the book was published in 2011, a cascade of bad news would seem to make it obsolete. Civil war in Syria, atrocities in the Islamic State, terrorism in Western Europe, autocracy in Eastern Europe, shootings by police in the United States, and hate crimes and other outbursts of racism and misogyny from angry populists throughout the West. But the same availability and negativity biases that made people incredulous about the possibility that violence had declined can make them quick to conclude that any decline has been reversed. In the next five chapters, I will put the recent bad news in perspective by going back to the data. I'll plot the historical trajectories of several kinds of violence up to the present, including a reminder of the last data point available when The Better Angels of Our Nature went to press. 7 years or so is an eye blink in history, but it offers a crude indication of whether the book capitalized on a lucky instant or identified an ongoing trend. More important, I'll try to explain the trends in terms of deeper historical forces, placing them within the narrative of progress that is the subject of this book. In doing so, I'll introduce some new ideas on what those forces are. I'll begin with the most extravagant form of violence, war. For most of human history, war was the natural pastime of governments, peace a mere respite between wars. This can be seen in Figure 11-1 in the accompanying PDF file, which plots the proportion of time over the last half millennium that the great powers of the day were at war. Great powers are the handful of states and empires that can project force beyond their borders, that treat each other as peers, and that collectively control a majority of the world's military resources. Wars between great powers, which include world wars, are the most intense forms of destruction our sorry species has managed to dream up, and they are responsible for a majority of the victims of all wars combined. The graph shows that at the dawn of the modern era, the great powers were pretty much always at war. But nowadays, they are never at war. The last one pitted the United States against China in Korea more than 60 years ago. The jagged decline of great power war conceals two trends that until recently went in opposite directions. For 450 years, wars involving a great power became shorter and less frequent. But as their armies became better manned, trained, and armed, the wars that did take place became more lethal, culminating in the brief but stunningly destructive world wars. It was only after the second of these that all three measures of war—frequency, duration, and lethality—declined in tandem, and the world entered the period that has been called the Long Peace. It's not just the great powers that have stopped fighting each other. War in the classic sense of an armed conflict between the uniformed armies of two nation-states appears to be obsolescent. There have been no more than three in any year since 1945, none in most years since 1989, and none since the American-led invasion of Iraq in 2003, the longest stretch without an interstate war since the end of World War II. Today's skirmishes between national armies kill dozens of people rather than the hundreds of thousands or millions who died in the all-out wars that nation-states have fought throughout history. The long peace has certainly been tested since 2011, such as in conflicts between Armenia and Azerbaijan, Russia and Ukraine, and the two Koreas. But in each case, the belligerents backed down rather than escalating into all-out war. This doesn't, of course, mean that escalation to major war is impossible, just that it is considered extraordinary, something that nations try to avoid at almost all costs. The geography of war also continues to shrink. In 2016, a peace agreement between the government of Colombia and Marxist FARC guerrillas ended the last active political armed conflict in the Western Hemisphere and the last remnant of the Cold War. This is a momentous change from just decades before. In Guatemala, El Salvador, and Peru, as in Colombia, leftist guerrillas battled American-backed governments, and in Nicaragua it was the other way around, American-backed Contras battling a left-wing government, in conflicts that collectively killed more than 650,000 people. The transition of an entire hemisphere to peace follows the path of other large regions of the world. Western Europe's bloody centuries of warfare, culminating in the two world wars, have given way to more than seven decades of peace. In East Asia, the wars of the mid-20th century took millions of lives, and Japan's conquests, the Chinese Civil War, and the wars in Korea and Vietnam. Yet despite serious political disputes, East and Southeast Asia today are almost entirely free from active interstate combat. The world's wars are now concentrated almost exclusively in a zone stretching from Nigeria to Pakistan, an area containing less than a sixth of the world's population. Those wars are civil wars, which the Uppsala Conflict Data Program, UCDP, defines as an armed conflict between a government and an organized force which verifiably kills at least 1,000 soldiers and civilians a year. Here we find some recent cause for discouragement. A precipitous decline in the number of civil wars after the end of the Cold War, from 14 in 1990 to 4 in 2007, went back up to 11 in 2014 and 2015, and to 12 in 2016. The flip is driven mainly by conflicts that have a radical Islamist group on one side, 8 of the 11 in 2015, 10 of the 12 in 2016. Without them, there would have been no increase in the number of wars at all. Perhaps not coincidentally, two of the wars in 2014 and 2015 were fueled by another counter-enlightenment ideology, Russian nationalism, which drove separatist forces, backed by Vladimir Putin, to battle the government of Ukraine in two of its provinces. The worst of the ongoing wars is in Syria, where the government of Bashar al-Assad has pulverized his country in an attempt to defeat a diverse set of rebel forces, Islamist and non-Islamist, with the assistance of Russia and Iran. The Syrian civil war, with 250,000 battle deaths as of 2016, conservatively estimated, is responsible for most of the uptick in the global rate of war deaths shown in Figure 11-2. That uptick, however, comes at the end of a vertiginous six-decade plunge. World War II at its worst saw almost 300 battle deaths per 100,000 people per year. It is not shown in the graph, because it would have scrunched the line for all subsequent years into a wrinkled carpet. In the post-war years, as the graph shows, the rate of deaths rollercoastered downward, cresting at 22 during the Korean War, 9 during the Vietnam War in the late 1960s and early 1970s, and 5 during the Iran-Iraq War in the mid-1980s, before bobbing along the floor at less than 0.5 between 2001 and 2011. It crept up to 1.5 in 2014 and subsided to 1.2 in 2016, the most recent year for which data are available. Followers of the news in the mid-2010s might have expected the Syrian carnage to have erased all of the historic progress of the preceding decades. That's because they forget the many civil wars that ended without fanfare after 2009 in Angola, Chad, India, Iran, Peru, and Sri Lanka, and also forget earlier ones with massive death tolls, such as the wars in Indochina, 1946 to 1954, 500,000 deaths, India, 1946 to 1948, 1 million deaths, China, 1946 to 1950, 1 million deaths, Sudan, 1956 to 1972, 500,000 deaths, and 1983 to 2002, 1 million deaths, Uganda, 1971 to 1978, 500,000 deaths, Ethiopia, 1974 to 1991, 750,000 deaths, Angola, 1975 to 2002, 1 million deaths, and Mozambique, 1981 to 1992, 500,000 deaths. Searing images of desperate refugees from the Syrian civil war, many of them struggling to resettle in Europe, have led to the claim that the world now has more refugees than at any time in history. But this is another symptom of historical amnesia and the availability bias. The political scientist Joshua Goldstein notes that today's 4 million Syrian refugees are outnumbered by the 10 million displaced by the Bangladesh War of Independence in 1971, the 14 million displaced by the partition of India in 1947, and the 60 million displaced by World War II in Europe alone, eras when the world's population was a fraction of what it is now. Quantifying this misery is by no means callous to the terrible suffering of today's victims. It honors the suffering of yesterday's victims, and it ensures that policymakers will act in their interests by working from an accurate understanding of the world. In particular, it should prevent them from drawing dangerous conclusions about a world at war, which could tempt them to scrap global governance or return to a mythical stability of Cold War confrontation. The world is not the problem, Goldstein notes. Syria is the problem. The policies and practices that ended wars elsewhere can, with effort and intelligence, end wars today in South Sudan, Yemen, and perhaps even Syria. Mass killings of unarmed civilians, also known as genocides, democides, or one-sided violence, can be as lethal as wars and often overlap with them. According to the historians Frank Chalk and Kurt Jonasson, genocide has been practiced in all regions of the world and during all periods in history. During World War II, tens of millions of civilians were slaughtered by Hitler, Stalin, and Imperial Japan, and in deliberate bombings of civilian areas by all sides, twice with nuclear weapons. At its peak, the death rate was about 350 per 100,000 per year. But contrary to the assertion that the world has learned nothing from the Holocaust, the post-war period has seen nothing like the blood flood of the 1940s. Even within the post-war period, the rate of deaths and genocides has juddered down a steep sawtooth, as we see in two data sets shown in Figure 11-3. The peaks in the graph correspond to mass killings in the Indonesian anti-communist Year of Living Dangerously, 1965 to 1966, 700,000 deaths. The Chinese Cultural Revolution, 1966 to 1975, 600,000. Tutsis against Hutus in Burundi, 1965 to 1973, 140,000. The Bangladesh War of Independence, 1971, 1.7 million. North against South violence in Sudan, 1956 to 1972, 500,000. Idi Amin's regime in Uganda, 1972 to 1979, 150,000. Pol Pot's regime in Cambodia, 1975 to 1979, 2.5 million. Killings of political enemies in Vietnam, 1965 to 1975, 500,000. and more recent massacres in Bosnia, 1992 to 1995, 225,000. Rwanda, 1994, 700,000. And Darfur, 2003 to 2008, 373,000. The barely perceptible swelling from